I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. Today is November 8th, 3 days after a shocking national election that will install Donald Trump as the 47th president of the United States. Many claim they predicted this outcome. Democrats, they say, didn't care to listen to the people. This is a truism. The candidate or party that loses did not get the pulse of the voters. But incredibly, I don't think Donald Trump himself expected this result. He is not some opaque personality able to hide his emotions, a characteristic that makes him attractive to those who support him. So when he sounded defeated, abandoned even by the likes of Nick Fuentes and Richard Spencer days before the election, it seemed Kamala Harris would prevail. What happened instead was astounding. A new coalition had arisen for Trump that unexpectedly included Hispanic men, many of whom would be connected by way of family, friends, and network to the 11 million undocumented deportables. Close to home, the results came in along expected lines. Angela Alsobrooks, the Democrat, trounced Republican Larry Hogan for the U.S. Senate seat. Of the state House seats, all but one fell along expected party lines. That is, Republican in District 1 and Democratic in District 2, 3, 4, 5, and 7. District 6 is still counting mail-in ballots. Democrat April Delaney holds a 500-vote edge over Republican Neil Parrott as of 4 p.m. on November 7th. Mail-in votes tend to favor Democrats. In Montgomery County, Board of Education candidates Natalie Zimmerman, Laura Stewart, and Rita Montoya won. Stewart and Montoya unseated incumbents, and Zimmerman defeated Brenda Diaz, who said on this podcast that she took her vaccination information from anti-vaxxer Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Maryland did enshrine reproductive rights in its constitution by way of a statewide ballot question. In Baltimore, the voters turned down ballot question H to reduce the size of the city council, but allowed the controversial redevelopment of Harbor Place to move forward. In Montgomery County, voters cut the county executive's term limit from 3 terms to 2. We will have more analysis of the elections next Tuesday. For this episode, I tracked down in Eastern North Carolina Montgomery County political activist Jill Ortman Faust, who appeared exhausted and spent and yet hopeful from working the last 3 months as the regional organizing director for the North Carolina coordinated campaign for Harris Walz. Ortman Faust, if you don't know, served as Montgomery County Board of Education member between 2014 and 2018, and remains a big progressive voice in the county. And she brings us the inside story of campaign work, the lessons she learned, and how she's thinking about moving forward. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the Washington, D.C. rock and roll band Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloos on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use 2 songs, Neutro and Juniper.
ask me anything, it's alright. I'll tell you I'm neutral. I'm really, really neutral, yeah. I'm neutral, yeah.
Jill Ortman Faust, welcome back to I Hate Politics.
I love politics.
You have spent an incredible amount of time and energy as part of the Harris campaign in North Carolina. This is not the day after you were hoping for. How are you feeling?
I am focused on what we need to do next. I am not going to cry in my coffee. I'm grateful. The volunteers down here could not have worked any harder. The level of commitment from the people who came into our office, who were ready to fight for democracy, it was just overwhelming. And our organizers that were here did the best job they could under very difficult circumstances. So I am proud of our team. I'm proud of the work that we did. I'm proud of our volunteers. And this is not a time to look backwards. It's a time to look forwards on what we need to be doing differently and more of to make sure this doesn't happen again. You know, every time I do a strategic planning session or work with an organization, I always have hot washes to say, okay, what went well? What could we improve on? How do we change our strategy? And I'm really hoping that the people at the top in North Carolina, the people on top of the national campaign, reach out and survey the people on the ground and say, what worked, what didn't work? I do feel that there could have been a lot more of that. I mean, they were dealing with the quantitative data, but I don't know how much time they had to really focus on the qualitative data that could have shaped the possibilities. We only had 3 months here to put together a winning campaign. And I mean, that happened across the country. But if we could build a structure where we stay invested in these areas, it wouldn't be that heavy a lift. It was a tremendously heavy lift because North Carolina wasn't considered in play. The structure wasn't here. So it had to be built from the ground up very quickly. It was really rough. I can tell you that. It was really rough. I think if you talk to any of our organizers on the ground who walked into their party chairs and their different counties offices and said, we're here, it was not the best. The people, the parties, the party chairs here have been working their butts off for so long and not getting the investment that they should get to do the work, especially in rural areas. And I think, you know, decisions from the top, I don't know where these decisions are made. I think it's they want to invest in the places where they feel they have the best chance. But we have to win voters everywhere.
One of the things that Maryland and Montgomery County does is that we send out volunteers. The politics here is fairly one-sided and, you know, in the favor of Democrats. So Democrats looking to have an impact will go to North Carolina and to Pennsylvania, to even to Virginia. But so this export economy that we have.
We had three buses of people come down and plus people who came down in carpools, people who came down alone, people came down by train, plane, and automobile. And every time they did, it made a difference because it was new, fresh energy because people who had been doing this for weeks were spent. They were tired. Going door to door, especially in rural communities, gravel roads, loose dogs, it'll tire you out. It'll really tire you out. We had three people in 1 week get bit by dogs. The people here have real fears. There are areas where they're scared to go. They don't want to get shot. You got Proud Boys in Elizabeth City. People in rural, under-resourced communities like the ones I was working in Eastern North Carolina have limited time and limited resources. like I say, the people in our office, like we'd have people come in and want to make phone calls. It's like, oh, you want to use the dialer? Can you bring your laptop in? I don't own a laptop. Okay, we're going to start at this time and work at that time. It's like, well, I don't have transportation. Can somebody pick me up? Most of the volunteers here in Rocky Mount were senior citizens. A whole lot of them were veterans. We had one guy who had done airlifts out of Vietnam in the 60s. He had a hearing impairment. He couldn't walk. He would bring donuts and pizza. So when people who are over-resourced in Montgomery County come down here, fresh-eyed, with energy, they were fearless. They went into areas where our volunteers had history and knew that it would be difficult for them. Former council member George Leventhal came down here three times. One time with his son, he trained volunteers how to knock doors, told them what to do, taught them how to use the minivan, took volunteers out. We had Senator Jeff Wallstriker come down here. Chris Van Hollen called the last bus that came down. It had broken down in Richmond. And he called and gave him a pep talk. I had a team of friends, college friends that came, friends from my neighborhood that went, that formed a strike force to go into Wilson specifically and work with Dante Pittman's team to make sure they got all those doors knocked. Dante Pittman was running for House District 24 in North Carolina. That was the one seat that flipped, that broke the supermajority in North Carolina, which was essential for Josh Stein, our new governor, to be able to get the work done. And not only am I grateful for all the volunteers here who do the work to get him to that point, but it was 850 voters or so. I fully believe if Maryland hadn't shown up here, if Montgomery County hadn't shown up here, we wouldn't have gotten those doors. We wouldn't have broken the supermajority.
Have you talked to your volunteers, both, you know, in state and in, you know, those that came down from Maryland, Montgomery County? I mean, how are they dealing with it? How are you talking to them about this?
It's interesting. George Leventhal just reached out to me this morning. He was listening to a podcast this morning. He's like, wow, our work really did make a difference. That was buoying his spirit. We're all devastated, but the down ballot races can be as important.
What is a coordinated campaign?
Yeah, the national campaign is the national campaign for Harris Walz. I got paid through the North Carolina Democratic Party. But the marching orders came from Delaware. So Delaware, D.C., talks to the state leaders. The state leaders feed it down to the organizing. And my region was Virginia over to the eastern part outside of Raleigh, Henderson, down to above Greenville, Kinston, over to the Outer Banks. We were given turf for each office, you know, precincts. We hit all of those precincts on a first pass, a second pass, and we're working on a third pass. In reflection, I think what I would have loved to have had was more doors. I think, you know, my field organizers were begging for new turf because there were so many doors that we could have knocked on that my organizers wanted to get knocked. The strategy was knock all doors three times, maybe in a universe of voters like in Raleigh or Charlotte. That made more sense in an urban area. But in a rural area, we needed, what we felt like we needed to do is knock as many doors the first time as we possibly could. In a hot wash, I would say we all could have coordinated more formally, a lot better.
So the coordinated campaign was not as coordinated.
We were a little uncoordinated. I mean, I'm just going to tell you that. One of my volunteers was a friend, Don Breen, from Montgomery County, who asked me the day she was worked very hard for our Wilson office and said, I really want to work with Megan, who is Dante Pittman's campaign chair, on the precincts. Should we continue to beat these doors that we've already beat twice, or can we get the organizers to hit these doors that Megan really needs hit? Dante's race is critical, and we did.
What is interesting in this that the coordinated campaign was coming up with a different set of doors, and the campaign was coming up with a different set of doors. Why is there this difference?
Everybody's got a different theory or philosophy of who you need to reach in what order to make the biggest difference for turnout. And people are going to be debating that for years. My organizers would tell me, you know, I'm trying to go in priority for these precincts, but this campaign has just been here. Like, we're knocking on the same door. I'm like, get out of that precinct, bump down to the next precinct. That's going to drive voters crazy if you're knocking on the same doors the same morning. The other thing is, we're supposed to be cleaning out the doors where people have already voted, you know, during early voting. So you're not knocking on doors, but it takes a minute. My takeaway is rural organizing is different from urban organizing. There is not a one size fits all. And there has to be data going both ways, not just from the top down, but from the bottom up. And we have to have the flexibility in our campaign to receive that data. We have a lot of Republicans out here in Eastern North Carolina. At one point, our coordinated made the decision to take off voter ID from minivan because research said that Democrats will skip Republican doors. And they want you knocking on every door because we were seeing that Republicans were voting for Harris. We lost our damn minds because we wanted to know. Our volunteers wanted to know whose door I'm knocking on because it impacts the conversation you have at that door. We did get that changed. But to that point, we absolutely had Republicans for Harris. One of our strongest supporters was a woman and a man who came in. And the woman said, well, I'm a lifelong Republican and I'm here to support Harris. And I want to knock on Republican doors. And she had fantastic conversations at the doors. On election day, they said that they turned out 6 voters on election day on their canvas. That's 6 voters that made a difference. They even did supporter housing for volunteers who came down here for weeks, which is another reason that I was erring on hope and confidence, because in Eastern North Carolina, Republicans were voting for Harris and they were all in.
So this is the crux at the national level. That door knocking effort, that entire ground game basically failed and failed big. I mean, it's not a small failure, but it worked for Josh Stein. It worked for.
Yeah. So I wouldn't. Yeah, right. Exactly. So I wouldn't say it was a failure. It was like on down ballot. We had beautiful successes.
So did you see this kind of distinction when you knocked doors? Did your volunteers see it?
Absolutely. They did. Absolutely. People said, I'm voting for Josh Stein and I'm voting for Trump. People were shocked. I heard it again and again because they knew Josh Stein. Josh Stein has an extremely good reputation in North Carolina.
You had Republicans for Harris.
Yes.
In Eastern North Carolina.
Yes.
Coming out to canvass.
Yep.
House volunteers from out of state. These things are not computing in
this. A lot of this doesn't make sense. I think this is going to take a long time to figure out what happened. But again, down ballot, Mo Green won for the superintendent of public schools for North Carolina. This is extremely important. He's been a district superintendent. He was running against a woman, a Republican.
So, but Jill, let me ask you this. To what extent did the coordinated campaign actually canvass on behalf of Mo Green?
Okay, we were the Harris campaign. Our lit was Harris lit. But in all of my offices, any candidate who gave us lit, we carried that lit. So we dropped that lit. So we, and if they, and on down ballot races, we're on minivan. So when they went to the doors, minivan is the app that we use to do canvassing. And that's what our launch is. It's explaining people how to download the app and how to use the app, how to ask the questions, how to record the answers. And there was a question on there that talked to the campaign for the Senate and House races. So they would know, they're supposed to know the doors that we've knocked on. So there should be some kind of coordination that way. But it's very hard to get through all those questions, as you know, when you're at the door. And there were a lot of questions and it was a long script.
Did the script come from national, state? Because the script was universally long, in my experience, everywhere.
That was something that I had no control over. That is absolute feedback that I would give is the script for both the phone and the doors was too long. People don't have that kind of time. And what we found to be, my organizers found to be the absolute most effective way to have persuasive conversations with voters was to listen, to say, what are the issues that are important to you? Let's talk about that. And then we did have talking points. And I'll tell you, our organizers and our volunteers, they knew the answers. They knew the answers. They knew how to have those persuasive conversations. They did hit, there was one weekend where we hit some very hard doors of people who were Trump supporters. That was a tough weekend, tough several days around the state where volunteers were knocking on doors that included Trump doors. The campaign had made a judgment call that perhaps we can scrape up some people there. And I think we did. The risk is you're also activating voters by giving them Trump voters information that will motivate them. It's more like reverse motivation to get them to the polls. Same thing with young people. You know, there was a lot of effort on young people. Turns out young people, we lost young people in a lot of ways. And did we motivate young people to get to the polls who actually did not vote for Harris? I think we could have done in the Delta a lot more formal Hispanic outreach in North Carolina in particular. We did have lit in Spanish, but I guess 3 months wasn't enough time to do the Hispanic outreach that we needed. That's why the campaign for the next 4 years needs to start right now and putting together those structures.
Why do you think that no matter how well organized you were, no matter how hard you tried, that didn't work?
Okay, when you're in an area where there's a lot of poverty, those $1,200 checks during COVID, people did credit Trump with that.
But Biden administration also sent checks.
They remember Trump's checks, and they didn't even remember that the Congress was the one who got it through and that Trump slowed it down. You know, you have to have bullet points for people, not big philosophical conversations about democracy. It's, can I afford eggs when I go to the grocery store? Eggs are more expensive. That was absolutely real here. Can I afford gas? Like, these people don't have what they need. They are under-resourced. And they're influenced by the media. When people are down on the luck, they need somebody to blame. And Trump gives you an easy answer, somebody to blame.
But there are two things here. The Biden administration claimed that the economy was actually improving.
Right.
And national statistics showed that. So is it the case that the national statistics were wrong? Or is it the case that no matter what Democrats said, that they were not going to convince this group of voters that Biden also sent checks, that in fact, Biden helped control the inflation? Is that a credibility problem?
Absolutely. So some has credibility, you know, and they had no idea that we're doing better than the rest of the countries in the world. We managed COVID better than the rest of the country in the world. Our economy was doing better than the rest. All they knew is I'm still suffering. It's 4 years later. The Democrats have been in charge. Trump is saying he can make things better. What have I got to lose?
What have you got to lose is Trump tax plan.
Did you read the book about the Koch brothers that my neighbor read?
Gene Meyer, yeah.
You know, North Carolina was a big experiment, a big petri dish of Republican policies. And one of those was breaking down the public school system. And as you know, Sunil, I have said this a million times. It's why I ran for the Board of Education. It's why I did all that PTA work for decades. Strong public education is the backbone of democracy. When you break down public education, when you are paying teachers the equivalent of what you did in the 90s in North Carolina, where you now have unlicensed teachers because teachers quit in droves, when you aren't investing in schools, there's a county here that hasn't had a new school building since the 1960s.
I accept the description of the problem, the long duration of its existence. If they haven't had a school building since 1960, the problem would have been similar in 2008, 2012. Deep-seated structural things that are sometimes they are overcome and sometimes they are not.
it makes a difference when you're taking the money, as they, the Republicans have successfully done, as when they got that supermajority, out of public schools and are funding vouchers for private schools. When you're sucking the money out of the public school system, it has the impact they wanted. So when I talked to young people here, I was shocked. I was shocked that they were Trump voters. But we had, at one training I went to, the trainer said, you know, just convince people to take in, instead of doing that Pilates class for an hour, to come knock doors. Our people out here, it's not taking off freaking Pilates classes. We had people who, I can't even tell you the range of health conditions people had. Like, social determinants are real in rural counties. We had people, multiple people, who were undergoing chemotherapy. We had a person who would go with her when she door knocked because she has seizures. We had people calling in, this is going to make me teary, all the time, who would say, I can't come in today because I have to babysit my granddaughter, you know, because mom's going to go get a treatment for sickle cell. I have to take care of my mom today.
The paradox of all this is, this, not your volunteers, but the larger population ends up supporting somebody that wants to gut public health care.
I know.
Why is it, in your view, that your volunteers understood that, but the others did not? I mean, what is the difference between the volunteer that came to you and the and somebody else that was like, no, I'm going to go with Trump, who's going to gut healthcare, but I need help?
I think we have not done a good job of providing the answers. And Trump's campaign filled the vacuum. Trump's messages have filled the vacuum through all of the different media that they control. We haven't done the education that we have to do. And I do think it's sort of like when they say elitist, I do believe it's sort of an elitism. I do. And that's what they see.
But how do you share information with somebody that doesn't want it?
I think we're making an assumption about them not wanting it. That's why I say these persuasive conversations at the door were effective. This is what I'm saying. It goes back to investing in our state parties, our local parties on the ground in these rural areas, forming those partnerships right now, inviting people in the door. I can tell you, when we popped in the 10 yards from the end zone and said, here we are, we're going to save you, it was difficult. It's like, where have you been?
I totally get it. Problem, though, is that who should invest in the party and local organization? The way American politics and a lot of American institutions are set up is, it is bottom up. So you generate resources from within the community and then work within the community. I mean, what is there? Who is going to go and say, no, I want to be in Eastern North Carolina making investments so that 4 years from now, we can make a more credible case? There is no entity like that. There isn't an entity on the Republican side either.
But they've done the structural changes in North Carolina. They've done the structural changes across the country that they needed to do to get what they wanted done. The gerrymandering, like, that we were up against was insane.
Who's going to pay for all of it?
Well, we came up with, what, $3 billion for the Harris campaign?
Well, so that's correct. That's exactly the point, that people donated a huge amount of money within the space of 3 months.
Who has built a multi-billion dollar company in 3 months and run it effectively and efficiently? You can have all the money, but you can't build a successful, I mean, that's a tall order.
It is a tall order. But what I would say is, even if you, I mean, the campaign structure that was built was very, very impressive, but it didn't work. Do we understand those underlying conditions clearly? Because some of the conditions that we talked about, let's say the defunding of public education, for example, is a long-term thing, right? The poverty that you're talking about in the rural areas is also not today. It's like a 50-year-old phenomenon.
But it was very easy for Trump to criticize from the outside and provide how he was going to change things. I get into office, gas prices are going to go down. Everybody's going to have great jobs. you know, groceries are practically going to be free. Like, he's just promising all these things.
He's promising
from the outside.
But based on things he hasn't done.
Absolutely. They don't care. They just, they're listening to the promise and they want that relief right now. I'm not talking about 4 years ago. I'm talking about right now.
They should have relief. But why would they believe somebody that has not delivered in the past?
People, humans have very short memories.
Maybe that's the answer, that we actually don't remember what happened to us 4 years ago. I mean, a million people died.
People have very short memories. And you believe what you heard yesterday. Even if we have a persuasion conversation too far back, and this is research too, other people can change that person's mind back again in the meantime. It's what did you hear yesterday?
If we do have that present bias, I'm not sure how you overcome that problem with better organizing, if at all it is possible.
It's about relationships. And what they say in organizing is people come for the candidate and stay for the organizer. And we found that in our office. Like, our people were like our family in our offices. I'm sorry to say that. They were like our family. Everybody got really close. And that was in 3 months. And if we build those relationships now, I think that we can, and we do it across the country and we invest on the ground. Like I'm saying, like, I think it'll make a difference. I think we'll be the top trusted resource, the trusted sources. And we can, how has any of this worked in any dictatorships across the world in history, where people were sucked into some kind of propaganda? And that's what we're trying to fight, is a propaganda battle.
Jill Ortmann-Faust, thank you. I hope the national campaign, wherever they are listening. We'll see you back in town.
Thank you, Sunil, as always.
What lessons should we draw from my conversation with Montgomery County political activist Jill Ortmann-Faust, who spent this campaign season as a regional organizing director for the Harris-Walz campaign in eastern North Carolina? The 2024 presidential election will be studied for a long time, most obviously for the effects which are promised to be so large as to be called the Fourth American Republic. After 1789, 1865, and 1936, the American state is going to be reorganized wholesale. Public health agencies, CDC, FDA, the National Institutes of Health, are going to be handed over to the champion of anti-vaccination in the United States, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Trump has promised to disband the Department of Education, which means possibly the privatization of federal student aid, which would be an earthquake in higher education. The EPA, NOAA, the Department of Energy may be repurposed at best. The economy of the Washington, D.C. region, where we are based, now sits on this political fault line. The election will also be studied to get to the reasons behind the failure of the Democratic Party to install the country's first female president after having run a strong campaign with wide expectations of success. My conversation with Jill Ortmann-Faust shows how hard it is to truly understand and act upon what went wrong. But there are many who already know why this happened and have joined the usual after-election defeated party circular firing squad. It's the economy, stupid, some say. Other versions of the economic argument bring up poverty, education, inflation, stimulus checks, but all of them suggest one thing. Voters just did not want to hear the Democratic message about improving economic situation, but were willing to accept Trump's false promises about simultaneously stemming prices and imposing general tariffs on imported goods. It is little consolation to be told that people don't understand how tariffs work, even though this information is readily and widely available. Could it be that national statistics informing the Democratic message were wrong? That the way the U.S. counts its production, its wages, and income are broken. That's not an argument made, but worth considering. And it may give us a way to think about the problem. Then there are those who say that Kamala Harris went too far to the left, and others who say that she went too far to the center. Yet others find answers in racism, sexism, and homophobia. No matter how hard we look, analyze, and debate, we will not find uncontested evidence around which a big consensus might form. What we will have instead are many hypotheses and continued uncertainty. Most political questions carry this immense burden, and this is why answers in politics are hardly simple. Those promising simple answers tend to be demagogues. I like to say that politics is harder than rocket science and brain surgery, if for no other reason than politics pays for those things directly or indirectly. Jill Ortman-Faust has a very important part of the answer. The truth about why the economy is bad, or why there is continued racism 50 years after the Civil Rights Act, or why there is sexism 100 years after women got the vote, or homophobia 2 years after the Respect for Marriage Act. That truth emerges from within relationships. They are social truths where pre-existing relationships drive cognition rather than some objective, measurable, incontrovertible fact. That relationship has evaporated for the Democratic Party as part of the great sorting that sent liberals out of rural areas and to congregate around big cities, and is now sending conservatives out of blue state cities and into red state, mostly exurbs. The solution, investing in places like Eastern North Carolina, raises the question, who should make that investment? Just because the Harris campaign raised $1.5 billion does not mean that similar money can be raised for staffing positions in rural party offices. Neither Democrats nor the Republicans possess that kind of capability. And politics and campaigns are very deliberately designed to be episodic and not permanent. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. rock and roll band, Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloes on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutral and Juniper. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihbpod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. See you next time.